Okay, good morning everyone and welcome to the BDNG podcast. My name is Molly and I'm one of the education nurses and I'm joined today by Ewan Downey. And today we're going to be talking about the topic of safeguarding. So first, Ewan, would you just maybe mind introducing yourself to everybody?
Hello, yes, thanks, Molly. My name is Ewan Dowie, and I'm Head of Nursing and Allied Health at the University of South Wales. And today we're discussing safeguarding. I've had a long career, 21 years at the moment at the university, teaching law and ethics, which included safeguarding. And I was in charge of a safeguarding module that looked at the legal principles and ethical principles in relation to safeguarding over the last 10 years. So, yes, I've also published a few articles, and I've also written a couple of books in relation to law and safeguarding as well.
And I think safeguarding is such a big topic, so maybe let's make it quite simple. What is safeguarding?
Yeah, thanks, Molly. It's a very good question. Safeguarding has multiple definitions, and one person's safeguarding definition will often be very different to another person's definition of safeguarding, which could be sometimes part of a problem that some people will not recognize safeguarding because they don't see it as a safeguarding issue, whereas other people will see that as a safeguarding issue. So that's why sometimes there are differences in approach. The Care Quality Commission describes safeguarding as being able to protect people's health, well-being, and human rights, and enabling people to live free from harm, abuse, and neglect. Some definitions will say it is to protect vulnerable people, but I have a few issues with using only the terms vulnerable, as it isn't always obvious as to who is vulnerable or whether you were feeling vulnerable at the time. For example, I might have someone stealing money from me, but I haven't noticed, so am I at this moment in time vulnerable? Yet I'm still subject to financial abuse. So safeguarding is something that applies to each and every one of us, whether we're vulnerable or not. So, it has a very broad definition. But all of us at some point will come under that safeguarding measure because all of us at some point will suffer some sort of physical harm, emotional harm, abuse. So no safeguarding applies to every person.
And why is safeguarding important? What makes it so vital as an aspect of nursing, I guess?
It's so important because we have to protect people we're looking after. So one of the reasons why safeguarding should be at the foremost of our minds is that people, when they come to be looked after by us, quite often are in that, and I'm going to use the term vulnerable, but often they're not feeling at their most optimal best. And obviously there's conditions then in place where they could be taken advantage of. There's conditions in place where they could be harmed. And so safeguarding is vitally important for a nurse in that regard to make sure that those people are being protected. So always having that safeguarding principles in the back of your head sort of helps you navigate patients away from having unnecessary harm.
Okay. And who is responsible for safeguarding? Would it just be registered nurses? Is it doctors? I think sometimes it's very difficult to know, especially when that patient does come across and you're thinking in the back of your mind, oh, something's not quite right. Who ultimately is responsible for that?
Well, safeguarding is everybody's responsibility. And I think although we don't have quite like what they have in France, a Good Samaritan law, where there's a duty placed upon people in general to report things where there's issues. In the UK, especially in the healthcare settings, most of us are working for an NHS trust. We're working for an organization which will they say that safeguarding principles is for everyone, whether you're a healthcare assistant, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a nurse. It applies to everybody. Obviously, where everyone will have slightly different roles within that safeguarding family. So there will be a high duty placed upon nurses, for example, and other allied health and medical staff because we have a professional code we also have to meet. But also because we've had that education, often at graduate level, then obviously there'll be a greater expectation that we would be able to deal with safeguarding issues in a more appropriate way than, say, somebody who hasn't perhaps been trained in the same approach. So we have a duty as a public body as well to ensure people's human rights are upheld. So we have that as part of the Human Rights Act. We also have a professional responsibility. The NMC and their code tell us that we have to prioritise people, and that includes ensuring that they are free from harm. And again, all the other professional codes will have a similar measure saying that safeguarding is important. We always have to think about it.
And this word comes up quite a lot in conversations about safeguarding that, there's a duty of care. What is duty of care and who does this apply to?
So duty of care is a legal and professional principle. It began with the case of Donoghue versus Stevenson back in 1932, so it's a very old case. But what it basically said in that case is that you need to foresee if any person or persons are likely to be harmed by your acts or omissions. So, for example, in safeguarding, if you saw someone with a bruise and you just accepted the relative's explanation that they were being clumsy and you didn't take any further action, that would be seen as an omission. So you would have failed in your duty of care to that person. So obviously, there's been a red flag raised, but you've accepted that other person's explanation. It may well be the cause case that the relatives are telling the truth, but without further investigation, you could be potentially exposing to that relative to further harm and an abuse as well. We have that legal duty of care. We have an ethical duty of care as well. So ethically, we want to make sure that people are being protected. We want to make sure that we're doing a very good job. We want to make sure that the people under our care are being cared for appropriately. But also, we also need to remember that our primary duty is to investigate our concerns. So if we have a concern about somebody, and say the relative is perhaps trying to influence what we're thinking, our duty ultimately is to that person, not to the relative. So whilst we must always have a rationale as to why we are seeking further investigation, we need to make sure that we are referring that appropriate situation to the relevant person. So that's where our duty of care would kick in. Where we have to be a bit careful, I suppose, any referrals that are based on stereotypes could potentially become discriminatory. So we have to be careful that we're not going into a sort of biased environment. So, for example, it might be easy to assume that if somebody comes from a particular community, that they're more likely to do a safeguarding issue. So, for example, I'm thinking of a traveling community there, that people have stereotypes in relation to certain communities, which could then influence how you react. Likewise, people tend to be different when it comes to a middle class couple. So again, class doesn't come into this. So you must always have that sort of neutral mindset that, if there's that concern that's been raised, or you feel that there's a red flag that's being raised, you still need to investigate, no matter what that person's background might be, no matter what your own personal biases might be, although you should always recognize your own personal biases. But you always need to make sure that that issue is being further investigated. It's very easy sometimes, and certainly in middle class households, to accept the explanation of somebody who's very articulate, who's very well spoken, and almost be influenced by the way they put things across. But ultimately, if somebody has got, for example, like a bruise, or they've got like signs of financial abuse, obviously making sure that is further investigated is our priority, and not how well that person, that relative, is perhaps articulating the issue.
And I think, kind of what you're saying is reflecting upon our own personal internal biases and recognizing that and seeing that that might sway us one way or another. But ultimately, that person in front of us needs us to go and say, actually, there might be something happening here to that person. And I think that can sometimes be quite difficult to recognize in ourselves and a lot of reflection. And a lot of, unlearning some of those biases that you might have been taught at a very young age, quite difficult.
And that's absolutely true, Molly. And I think, safeguarding is not an easy issue. And I think it's easy to judge after the event. And you often find where mistakes have happened, people have said, well, why did the social worker do that? Why did the nurse not pick up on that? But we've got to remember, living in a time of limited resources, people are overworked, and sometimes, things do get missed. And it's easy in hindsight to say, well, they should have done that. And that's why safeguarding will never be completely eliminated, safeguarding issues, because obviously mistakes will happen. We're human beings as well. But it's recognizing those learning points, and obviously there's serious case reviews and various other procedures that allow that to happen. And we've had various reports, like the Lamin reports and so forth in the past, that have talked about how we need to do things better. So sharing information with other agencies was a key thing from a Lamin report. So, that's why we do have to share safeguarding concerns with others. There's a little bit of a misconception because of GDPR, the Data Protection Act 2018, where people say, oh, I can't share because it might be a GDPR issue. And people are very frightened of GDPR or data protection issues. But when it comes to safeguarding, we are allowed to share those concerns with social services, with the police, with other parties. So, we shouldn't be frightened about GDPR in that regard, because GDPR says that you can share safeguarding concerns with other agencies. But sometimes people get very frightened of sharing things because of that data protection issue.
And I think what you're talking about, the learning from these case reviews, the Lemmy report, there have been changes in laws, particularly in Scotland. I'm not so much sure about in England, but for example, in Scotland, there's been a change in the law regarding controlling behavior. how does that kind of change, you know, what we're doing in terms of safeguarding and making sure that we're up to date with all these changes, with all these, you know, when the reports are coming about, with all the recommendations, how do we handle that as healthcare professionals?
Yeah, thanks, Molly. Well, the laws have changed, and they've changed right across the UK, England and Wales as well. Obviously, Scotland has a separate legal jurisdiction to England and Wales, has separate a criminal law area as well. But the Domestic Abuse Act 2021 was UK-wide, and there might be slight modifications depending which part of the UK you live in, but generally the same principles apply. And it has been a catalyst in changing the definition of domestic abuse. We tend to think of domestic abuse, for example, as being very much about violence, and about people being, you know, sort of salt and battery kind of concerns. But basically, it moved away from that physical act and started talking about the psychological elements of safeguarding. So, you know, we very much focused on the physical for a very long time. Now we're looking at the psychological. And that can include coercive and controlling behaviour and emotional and financial abuse. The Serious Crimes Act 2015 also made coercive and controlling behaviour a criminal offence. If people are found guilty of those two things, then obviously they can be sent to prison. So again, it provided extra protections, and it allowed people to come forward whereas perhaps in the past they didn't feel that they had a voice. So, you know, if they were being emotionally controlled, if they were being abused financially, they probably didn't have many places to go to. They weren't able to raise those concerns, but now they are able to do that. So it gives permission for them almost to be able to say, this is happening to me and you know, I need help. Likewise, I think from a nursing point of view, it's very important that we spot the signs of some of those things. So controlling and coercive behaviour, one of the signs would be things like the person suddenly becoming very withdrawn or the person not speaking and the relative speaking on their behalf. It could be that the relative always wants to stay by their side. It could be that when it comes to financial issues, they provide the relative with a small amount of money, but they control the economics of that. So they control the bank accounts of that. So again, I think as nurses, we have to be mindful that that can happen. You know, we could be seeing somebody in a clinic. We could be seeing somebody at the bedside, and we're noticing sometimes those controlling behaviours. Now, it might be that that person is happy for those things to happen. It might be that that person doesn't see an issue in it. But it might be that that person does feel controlled. That person does feel that that person is exerting that coercive behaviour. So again, it's sort of looking for those red flags, but also then deciding what we do with those red flags. And that's where we have to be a little bit careful, because obviously sometimes there is a cultural issue attached to it. Sometimes there's proportionality we need to think about as well. So, you know, if we're seeing certain things that we feel needs further investigation, again, always refer to somebody, refer to your safeguarding lead, refer to somebody else for further advice. And of course, they'll be up to date with all the latest safeguarding legislation. So they will be able to provide advice to you. But it's not an easy thing to identify, and it can be very, very subtle how that person is being controlled. So, you know, it's a very difficult area, and we haven't seen many prosecutions yet for controlling and coercive behavior, but we'll probably see more as the legislation sort of becomes more established.
Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of these cases it often isn't something that has very good empirical evidence. It's often just a gut feeling that, oh, you know, there's something not adding up with this family, or not adding up with this, you know, relative, or not adding up quite right here. And I think sometimes you do, you know, you might pass it on your handover, and then you might pass it on to the social working team, and then, you know, you kind of don't really know what happens beyond that. So I think my next question is, you know, let's say I decided to report something that I thought, I'm not quite sure I'm going to report that. Who ultimately, you know, makes the decisions about the safeguarding? Would that be the safeguarding team? Is that social work? Is it the police? Or does it just depend on the circumstance, I guess?
It can depend on the circumstance, but often there'll be a multi-agency meeting that would be set up. So if there's a very serious safeguarding concern that somebody has raised, you might not ever get any feedback. That's the issue. You've done your referral, you've passed it on to say your safeguarding lead within the health board. You might not necessarily get the feedback that you might feel you want, because obviously it gets taken out of your hands and it goes to other areas. You might be involved because you might have to provide a witness statement. You might have to be involved with a court process or any other legal process that might be attached to it. So, very much depends on often they'll do a case conference, often they'll have a multi-agency sort of safeguarding group. And again, they'll have police involvement, they'll have local authority involvement, they'll have a safeguarding needs for the health board or NHS trust. And again, the decisions would be made at that time, whether or not to further investigate or whether or not to make any actions. Who has the ultimate decision? Often these things are chaired by the local authority. So you could argue technically the local authority would probably make the ultimate decision, but it's always done in consensus with the rest of the group, which will include representatives from the NHS Trust, from the health boards, from the police, from social services, and from any other person that might need to be involved as well. So, it's not quite as simple as to is it down to one individual? It's usually a group of individuals that will say that we need to do something here. And then they'll come up with a plan of action as to what should happen. So it might be that they need to remove that person from that environment, or it might be that they need to perhaps monitor what's happening first. I suppose the difficulty with all these things is that if you're looking at it from a police perspective, you need the evidence as well. So as you said, a lot of times we do things on gut feeling. We have an uneasy feeling about this, and we'll refer it on. But from the police, from their perspective, they need to have the evidence to be able to successfully prosecute or to continue the investigation. So they need to have prima facie evidence initially. So on the face of it, this is what's happening. There's some evidence to show that there's something going on. And then they need to obviously gather more evidence in order to, get that successful prosecution as well, if necessary. And that can take a very long time. So safeguarding procedures are not quick. I've known some people to be in the system for 2 to 3 to 4 years sometimes, because the length of time it takes to do the investigations to get that evidence that's needed. And often witness statements are coming from vulnerable people as well, people who perhaps perhaps have limited capacity. So again, that can complicate how prosecutions go forward. So, it's not an easy process. But I think what we always have to remember is that our essential duty is to be able to refer that matter on. We have to do our duty as a professional, that we're doing something with that information that we've found, or that sort of behaviours that we feel are concerning, and that we are referring to the appropriate person. What eventually happens sometimes we might have limited control over.
And I think that can be sometimes quite difficult because you want to know, oh, what was the outcome of this? What happened to that person? But sometimes you won't ultimately find out. But as you say, the important thing is letting somebody know, I have a concern about X, Y, and Z. I've raised it. At least now it's logged in the system, it's logged in that person's notes. So maybe the next time they come across another care provider, the same thing happens. The more voices that are added into that, I think can be beneficial to that person that we're ultimately trying to protect from harm.
That's right. And the other thing, well, it can be very frustrating because you might find that there's no further action, and yet you've still got that feeling that something's happening. And that can be very, very difficult because, you're thinking, well, that person is still in that potentially dangerous situation. And yet, because there's no further action, it would feel like that nothing is happening. But I think we've always got to be mindful that you can still re-refer if we still feel that we're not happy about things. But it can be very frustrating. And what some people do sometimes, if I'm being honest, they give up. They'll say, well, I've done what I can, that's it. We decided that there's no further action. So they sort of step away. And sometimes that can be also quite difficult. And also potentially that keeps that person perhaps even more at risk of harm because there's no longer that involvement from other healthcare professionals because they stepped away from it. So, but none of this is easy, and it is a very difficult thing to do, safeguarding. And also you can be criticized for raising a concern. Other healthcare professionals can criticize you for raising the concern. So it can be a very lonely place as well. So, which is why, I'd like to think that the attitudes are changing, but it can take quite some time for those attitudes to change. So it can be a very lonely place to be. And we saw that in Mid Staffordshire, where nurses were raising concerns and yet weren't being listened to. And then they were the ones that were being called the problem because they were raising concerns about patient safety and patient care. And we saw in subsequent documentaries how they felt. They felt very vulnerable. They felt very upset, and they felt very lonely as well.
And I think this is just, it's such a complicated subject that it just warrants itself to almost tying knots of different things all together, you know. The next question that I have is about the six principles of the CARE Act. Can you tell me what the six principles are and how do they apply to safeguarding?
Yeah, thanks, Molly. The six principles is accountability, empowerment, partnership, prevention, proportionality, protection, and they all apply to safeguarding, but I'll go through each one, briefly. So accountability, the first one is that we're always accountable anyway by being professionals, but also we're accountable to the person. So we must make it clear to the person who's reporting a safeguarding concern that you do have a duty to report, you're accountable for that, and you also have a duty to share that information with the relevant agency. So it's important that the person who's perhaps raising concerns with you understands that that information can't stay with you either. This is where another complication comes in with safeguarding. Sometimes somebody will say, I'm telling you this in confidence, and then will say something that is very alarming, but legally you do have to share with other agencies. So sometimes having that open conversation with that person saying anything you do share, potentially if it's in relation to safeguarding, I will have to then share with other relevant agencies, that can be an important starting point. As I said, you're also accountable for any acts or omissions. So always make a record of any referrals you have made and any conversations with the person providing you with that information. Even if the person is not reporting concerns to you, but you notice behaviours that are suspicious, for example, always staying, the person's always staying quiet while the partner does all the talking, document those behaviours, make sure it's all documented. Because again, if later on it does go to court or it goes to a professional hearing, then at least you've got that evidence there. You've got that evidence to say you've had that conversation. But also within that documented evidence, say what you did about that. Who did you refer that matter to? So again, that protects you from a legal point of view as well. Empowerment, that's ensuring that the person who has suffered or is suffering abuse is still in control. So it's making sure that their voice is heard as well, that their decisions matter. This can be difficult, as sometimes the person will want to continue, for example, in that abusive relationship. And the police sometimes will take no further actions we've already discussed previously due to a lack of evidence. But it's important not to judge and to ensure that this person knows that they can still talk to you at any time. So in the past, when people stayed with a partner that, the nurse might have thought, well, that's an unhealthy relationship, sometimes they'll say, well, they've made their own bed, they can lie in it. But then that created a barrier for that person to ever come back to that health professional to say, look, I'm still having issues, I'm still having problems. So it's making sure that you don't judge that person, that if that person does stay in that particular environment, that we're still open to listening to their concerns, that we're still open to taking action if we need to take action as well. So I think that's very important from an empowerment point of view, but they still have control, but they still have that ability to access you as well. And you can decide together what that plan should be.
Yeah, there's a factoid about, I think, from people with domestic violence that it takes, I think, 13 attempts or something. It's more than 10 attempts to get away from domestic violence or a abusive situation. So I think that is an important point to make. I will let you continue.
No, thanks, Molly. And I think, what you're saying there is absolutely true. And it can be frustrating from a healthcare professional, but also at the same time, our job, as I said, is not to judge. So I think that non-judgmental attitude is absolutely vital. Partnership, nurses need to work with the various agencies. Obviously, we have that under the Care Act in England, and well, in England only. Under the Care Act, you have a duty to share. There's similar duties in Scotland and Wales as well, information, but also we need to work with local authorities and other agencies as well. We still need to work in partnership with the patients, the relatives, all those people are part of that partnership. But of course, when we talk about working in partnership, it doesn't mean that means we always have to act by what one of those partners say. So if we disagree with, for example, for what the relative says as their account, then we can still continue to work with social services to try and make sure that the person that we're ultimately focused on is being safeguarded as well. But obviously, that partnership working is absolutely vital, and that we make decisions that ultimately will protect the person that potentially could be suffering some sort of abuse. Prevention, this again is not quite as straightforward as it sounds. So a simple explanation is that we need to act before any harm takes place. So the definition of harm for safeguarding is significant harm. And that can be a difficult thing to work out. What is significant? What isn't significant? What is harm? What isn't harm? So safeguarding always talks about significant harm. So this person is in real danger of suffering real serious harm, or in some cases potential they could die from what's happening as well. So there's that significant bit to think about. So, but that's very subjective. You know, one person's significant harm might be different to another person's significant harm. So again, not easy, but you know, we do need to understand that it has to be significant. So, for example, we might recognize a carer is under a lot of strain and there's a real risk that they could seriously harm their relative if action isn't taken. So, you know, perhaps there's things that we can do to try and prevent that from happening. So we could, arrange with social services respite care for that person. We could have full social services involvement to make sure that carer is being supported. And again, that can mitigate the risk of harm. And of course, in very serious and immediate cases, you will probably need to involve the police, because obviously there's a real serious risk that person could have their life in danger, or they could suffer some really significant injuries. And then moving on, proportionality, again, another subjective one. So this is where we have to use our usually professional judgment. So for example, if there were only some indications that someone has been harmed, or somebody could be harmed, either physically or psychologically, you might only refer to safeguarding lead or social services. It might be, under those circumstances, disproportionate to report it to the police. So proportionality, again, is something that we have to take actions that are proportionate to the situation and to the types of harm that's being occurred. So in some cases, if it's low-level harm, that person might be happy. I shouldn't say happy, it's probably the wrong word to use, but might be content with that certain element of harm. So it might be that person does have full control of a bank account, which potentially could be controlling, but that person is happy for that person to have full control of the bank account. There might be various reasons for that. So, you know, getting social services involved in those situations might be disproportionate. But again, what I would always say, if you're not sure whether it's going to be proportionate or disproportionate, always seek advice from your safeguarding lead in whichever organisation you work in. And then protection, which is the last one, it's making sure you remain accessible to the person, that you're not judging that person, so you can continue having that open dialogue. It's also ensuring you do all the things we've just said to ultimately protect that person. So it's making sure that, you know, we are doing that partnership working. We are sharing that information. We are empowering that person to be able to make their needs known. We are thinking about accountability and all those things. We're doing all those things together, then that will ultimately help protect that person.
And I think we've touched on this before, but there is now, I think, the duty of candor in the Health and Social Care Act, which was derived from the Francis report about poor practice. And you've touched upon the mid staffs, where nurses were feeling, although they've reported the bad practice, maybe, you know, some of them were targeted as, well, you're the bad actor or you're the bad apple in this situation. Can you comment a little bit about that and, you know, what exactly kind of is our duty of candor if we are seeing, you know, maybe practice that isn't up to good standards or that we are concerned about?
Yeah, no, thank you. So the Health and Social Care Act of 2008 has said that we all have a duty of candor. So it's something that's legally enshrined as well as professionally enshrined, and our codes will also reflect that duty of candor. We do have to speak out when we see poor practice. Again, easier said than done, because I've already mentioned how people can sometimes feel alienated, how sometimes management can sometimes make you the problem, so to speak, and that can be very difficult to sort of continue raising your concerns. But we do have some legal protections, so we are allowed to whistleblow legally if we see really poor practice, and again, if an organisation tries to dismiss you whilst you are, you know, appropriately whistleblowing, then again, There's a case at the Employment Tribunal if that does happen. But also, I mean, ultimately, we come into nursing or any medical profession to basically, protect people, to protect patients. We want to make sure that they're getting the best care possible. So if we're seeing colleagues doing things that is suboptimal, that could lead to potential harm to either other patients or colleagues themselves, then we have a duty to step up and say, this is wrong, this shouldn't be happening. And how we do that depends on what they're doing. So if it's low level, again, having a conversation with that colleague in the first instance would probably be appropriate, where we can say, well, you know, you were a little bit sort of rough with that patient there when you were, you know, sort of moving them into a chair or whatever it might be, and perhaps need to think about how you're sort of doing that. But if we feel that they're not learning from that and they're continuing the same sort of approaches, or if we see something even more serious, then obviously we have a duty to report that to the line manager or to whoever might be responsible in relation to being able to investigate further. So yeah, it's not an easy duty to meet, duty of candor, because it does mean that you will have to put your head above the parapet, and that can be very difficult for some people. But it's important that we do that, because that protects ultimately patients and colleagues as well. So the NMC in particular has taken much more of a serious line when it comes to colleagues being harmed as well in the workplace by other colleagues. We've seen bullying, for example, which ultimately will impact upon safeguarding, because if you're feeling bullied as a person, then will you necessarily pick up on patients coming with, you know, signs of perhaps coercive control because you yourself are feeling so demoralized by being bullied by somebody else? So all these things have an impact. So again, the NMC have taken a much stricter view when it comes to workplace bullying and so forth. And also, you know, it's important that patients as well feel safe. And if there are colleagues in there that are making patients feel unsafe or they're putting patients in an unsafe position, then obviously, yeah, it's part of our code, but also it's part of our own sort of values. I think it's important that we speak up.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a culture of learning is better than a culture of blame. Because if it's a culture of blame, people are not going to want to say, oh, I made a mistake or, you know, something happened. Whereas if it is a culture of, well, why did that happen? You know, what made that happen? You know, it helps that area grow and learn from, you know, and I think that's more supportive than blaming a person for
it
saying,
is.
Something is going wrong here, you know.
And I think it goes back to the days when people used to do drug errors and they didn't report the drug errors because they were more frightened about how management would see that drug error. Whereas we all know that when we make a drug error, we have to report it because it's for the safety of the patient. It's for the safety of you as well, by being able to reflect upon that and then improving your practice. But in the past, people often kept quiet when they made mistakes because they were frightened of our blame culture. So again, from a safeguarding perspective, it's about being open. And sometimes we will make mistakes. Even in our safeguarding roles, we will make mistakes. Whereas identifying where we've made those mistakes, being open about those mistakes and making sure that we're learning from those mistakes. So yeah, you're absolutely correct there, Molly. That's really vital in making sure that people continue to be protected.
And when we're thinking again about, you know, reporting these things, whether or not it's a circumstance at work where practice might not be the best, whether it's a patient who we're concerned about, when we're passing on the information, who is ultimately responsible
for safeguarding? Again, there's probably not one single person that's ultimately responsible. I suppose in most organizations there will be a senior safeguarding lead. They are ultimately responsible for, you know, so if you're referring things on and it comes to their desk, then they're ultimately responsible for making sure that appropriate action is taken. The problem, I suppose, sometimes for safeguarding is that it doesn't always get to that high level. So sometimes it gets missed. So it might go up from, so you might refer it on to the ward manager. The ward manager might refer it on to somebody else. And then sometimes he can sit on somebody's desk for a while as well. So ultimately that person then will become responsible because they haven't done the appropriate referral as well. So I suppose safeguarding ultimately, as I said originally, it's all our responsibility. But once you've received a referral, then you have to do something with that as well. So you're responsible. Yet then again, you could refer on, but then that person then becomes responsible. So, you know, it's almost like a hierarchy of responsibility. But ultimately, for very serious concerns, it will go to the lead safeguarding professional, whether I'll be a nurse or an allied health member. And they will obviously then have the ultimate responsibility. And they have the ultimate responsibility then to the directors of nursing and various other senior people within the organisation.
And I think that touches upon, you know, the NMC accountability aspect of that you're an accountable professional, you're accountable for your actions.
Yeah.
You know, certainly, I know from our perspective, when we've had previous concerns in our department, we've always documented in the notes, like, raised concern with blah blah blah, you know, put in the referral to social work, the number that we've put, you know, it comes up with a number, that's documented in the patient's notes, so that way we know that it has happened. Because sometimes I think the thing is that we go, oh yes, I've done it on the portal, but I haven't put it in the patient's notes, so has it actually happened or has it not actually happened? So it's just that, again, that accountability is yourself as a professional following whatever your guidance is and your local trust of how you document that.
Absolutely, Molly, and that's the thing. I mean, there will be various different guidances available, and some. I mean, I don't know about Scotland, but in Wales, for example, we have an overarching policy. We have the All Wales Safeguarding Policy, which applies to every organisation in Wales, certainly public organisations anyway, in relation to safeguarding. So, again, very important to understand that, you know, there are those policies out there, and we have to be familiar with them. And again, within those policies, it should say who the appropriate person is. Ultimately, that's in charge of those safeguarding issues. So I think it's important to identify those people as well. So many people I talk to, and they don't even know who their safeguarding lead is, which always slightly concerns me, because they're one of the very few people you should know in an organisation. You might not necessarily know who the chief executive is, or who the person who's in charge of finance, but knowing who your safeguarding lead is very important.
And, you know, we've touched on a lot of, you know, different laws, a lot of different reports, a lot of different, you know, there's been changes in terms of guidance, the different laws and things like that. Is there, you know, a way that we can help keep up to date with the kind of requirements from a professional perspective? Would that be e-learning? Would that be, you know, university? How do we kind of try and stay on top of this, I guess?
So most organisations should have some sort of safeguarding training as mandatory, and that would be good practice. If they haven't, then they should. You know, yeah, e-learning, any kind of learning, whether it be face-to-face at a university or in a college, or whether it be, you know, distance learning, would be absolutely fine. And again, I think it should be part of people's, you know, sort of reflections that they provide to the MC as well. But they're thinking about safeguarding, because safeguarding is so vital to everything that we do. Obviously, reading articles, reading books, that helps as well. But obviously, we have to document what we've learned from that as well. Reading is one thing, but it's how we apply that to practice is important. I think also discussing concerns through things like clinical supervision. Some organisations have clinical supervision groups. And again, safeguarding issues can be brought up there. You know, it's usually, you know, clinical supervision usually has strict guidelines in regards to confidentiality. As long as you're not mentioning persons' names, then you can discuss an issue with them, and sometimes you can get a further sort of learning from that. And also reflecting upon safeguarding issues as they arise. You know, we all come across situations where we have felt uneasy, we have made a referral, and sometimes it's affected us as well. So reflecting on that is really important. And other people can learn from you as well. So if you've dealt with a situation, then you might have a junior member of staff who's never faced that situation before, even a senior member of staff might not have faced that situation before. So again, that sharing how you dealt with that, obviously keeping confidentiality as best as you can be really important to that sort of interprofessional learning as well. And also discussing it with other people. So doctors sometimes are not the best at safeguarding. So sometimes you have to explain to our medical colleagues what safeguarding is. Same for allied health. So, you know, it's about sharing that information amongst all the different professional groups would be really important. I suppose my final point, I suppose, Molly, to mention on all of this, we can do all this learning. We can make sure that we are keeping ourselves up to date. We're making sure we're looking at all the legislation. I think what we've always got to remember, people will always suffer serious harm. No, any safeguarding measure will never eliminate that harm. Harm will always happen. The purpose of safeguarding policies and keeping up to date and understanding the legislation is to mitigate the amount of harm that happens. But it's also to tell people that there is that legal protection from harm, you know, and that we can ultimately take action in relation to safeguarding. So I think, you know, we're always going to see horrible stories in the press, and there will always be a serious case review. There will always be another Victoria Climbier. That will always happen. But we're trying to reduce the amount of times that happens. And I think that's what safeguarding is about. Yes, I think we would all ideally love to eliminate all safeguarding concerns and issues. But we know that realistically, that's not going to be possible. But realistically, it is possible to reduce the amount of really serious events out there. And I think, you know, that e-learning and all those other things that we can do helps towards mitigating the amount of harm that can occur. So if you remember back, I mean, I know, I'm talking about my age now, go back to the 80s and the 70s, you know, there were lots of safeguarding issues that today, you know, probably we wouldn't see so many issues with, because people didn't talk about safeguarding in the same way as they do now. So people didn't talk about domestic violence. It was still possible in the 1980s for a man to legally rape his wife. That's now illegal. So there's lots of things that have changed, and for a very good reason. So we are seeing less of these issues coming forward. because or we're seeing sometimes we're seeing more of it in some respects because people are more likely to report it as well. So, you know, some things have sort of become less and less, and other things are becoming more reported because people feel they can report it. So domestic violence has increased in reporting from the 80s because people feel more free to report it. So, you know, there's lots of good things happening in safeguarding that we can't lose sight of. And it's very easy to be very despondent when we see the bad stories and think none of it's working, where in reality it is working. It's just that sometimes there will be that thing that slips through the gap that causes that really serious issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's always the saying, isn't there, that for every one negative story, there's probably a thousand positive stories of where actually something that has been reported or has been signposted has prevented that person coming to harm, or a good thing has happened and there's been good feedback and, you know, that person's felt supported, or that, you know, that team has come together and changed their whatever was, you know, not working well or whatever. So there is sometimes, I think, the focus of potentially more on the negative side than on the positive side. But I'm leaning with you of the hope that the more that we are open, the more that we are raising these things, the more that we're learning about it, that, you know, it will eventually be much more, rather than reactive, it will be a more preventative situation.
No, absolutely. No, I agree.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning. If anyone wanted to maybe get in touch with you or learn more about what you've written, would you be okay sharing that information, or would you rather them get in touch with me to find out that information?
No, but more than happy to contact me directly. I mean, my name is quite unusual, so you'd probably find me quite quickly on a Google search. So, because my name is, you know, Ewan Dowie, so it's IWANDOWIE. And again, if you pop that into Google, you'll find my email address for, you know, at the university. And then if people want to contact me, they're more than happy to do so.
Great. And again, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Molly, as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope you all have a nice rest of your morning.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch